Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org. Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back here to the Audio Stash today. It is Monday, December 3rd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal. Help us end marijuana prohibition in America. You can make a big difference right now by visiting norml.org to make your donation or join Normal today. We have an excellent week of programming again for you this week here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Some of the guests this week will include Dale Gerringer, the coordinator at California Normal. We'll speak with Dale about the Camp Marijuana Eradication Program, the growing marijuana industry in California, as well as some of the continued federal raids on medical marijuana facilities there. Dale will join us in Wednesday's Audio Stash this week. Also in the program, syndicated columnist Froma Harrop. She had a very interesting column picked up by dozens of papers last week calling on Senator Barack Obama and other presidential candidates to take a stronger stand against the war on drugs. And she feels especially strongly about marijuana decriminalization. We'll speak with Froma here later this week on the program. Also joining us this week is Aaron Houston, the Director of Government Relations at the Marijuana Policy Project. We'll be looking forward at some of the reform initiatives of 2008 with Aaron. Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst, will join us this week. And we have brand new segments with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, our Cannabis Science segment on Wednesday, and with Steve Bloom in our CelebStoner.com segment on Friday. A wonderful week of programming here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Make sure to vote for us up at Podcast Alley. That voting flips over every month. And tell all your friends who are getting brand new iPods for Christmas and Hanukkah and the holidays. Make sure that they link up to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, Normal News, and Normal Events podcasts right up on iTunes. Today, here on the program, we're going to hear from two of the strongest female voices in the marijuana law reform movement. This is audio from the 2007 Normal Conference. We'll hear from Allison Chin Holcomb. She's an attorney for the ACLU Drug Policy Reform Project and has worked extensively in the Kings County area and on Washington state legislation. She's speaking on the legislative panel at the 2007 Normal Conference. Also, we'll hear from Madeline Martinez, really one of my personal heroes. Madeline runs Oregon Normal, and she's getting ready to put up the annual Oregon Medical Cannabis Awards Show up there. We're going to hear from Russ Belville, Radical Russ Belville. More about the Oregon Medical Cannabis Awards from Russ and Madeline upcoming weeks. Today, we're going to play a presentation Madeline gave about Oregon legislation at the 2007 conference. Folks, never wonder if marijuana law reform and legalization will happen. In fact, right now is a very interesting time because the tide has really turned in many ways. There are so many articulate, well-informed individuals working on this problem right now. And again, some of the best presenters of the reform message and some of the hardest working people out there in this movement are women. And these two voices we're going to share today from the 2007 conference, both Allison and Madeline, are two women who set a shining example of the kind of effort and personality it takes to succeed in our cause and in our goal. So let's begin. First, we'll hear Allison Chin Holcomb at the 2007 Normal Conference in Los Angeles, California. Allison has joined us in interviews here on the Audio Stash as well. And then we'll hear Madeline Martinez, the director of Oregon Normal. Both are discussing pieces of state legislation. And you can link up to videos, photos, and audio of the 2007 Normal Conference right up on a special webpage at normal.org. We have links right to the conference page on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Here's Allison Holcomb, introduced by Normal Senior Policy Analyst Paul Armentano.
Thanks a lot, Jesse. Our next speaker is Allison Chin Holcomb, who is an attorney, and she is director of the ACLU's Washington State Marijuana Education Project. She has served for more than a decade as a criminal defense attorney, specializing in asset forfeiture law cases. In 2007, she was she earned the title of Super Lawyer by Washington Law and Politics magazine. She's going to speak to us briefly today about a change in Washington State's medical marijuana law. And this was a campaign that for some people was controversial and for some people in the patient community was a bit divisive. Clearly, one of the most controversial aspects of this change in law was that it appointed the Department of Health to codify in the law what a presumptive 60-day supply of marijuana should be for patients. When the 1998 medical marijuana law was passed in Washington, it did not give details as to what a 60-day supply of marijuana should be, and as a result, you have law enforcement essentially making that determination, and it varies from county to county, almost from individual police officer to individual police officer. By 2008, the Department of Health now has an obligation to come up with the details of a 60-day supply of marijuana for patients, and here to talk about that is Ms. Chin Holcomb.
Thank you for that very warm welcome. Paul was absolutely right. It was a very controversial legislative session, so it's always nice to have applause when your name is mentioned instead of boos and hisses. Let me give you a little background about the Washington State Medical Use of Marijuana Act. It was originally passed by voter initiative in 1998 with 59% of the vote. Every year since its passage, there's been at least one bill introduced in the Washington State Legislature to try to improve it or clarify it or deal with problems that have come up through courts' interpretations of what various provisions of the Act have meant. This year in 2007 was the first year that the legislature finally passed a bill addressing medical marijuana. They passed it by over two-thirds majorities in both the House and the Senate of our legislature. And in fact, I had forgotten this, but since it was mentioned earlier, John Walters did contact our governor before she was to sign it, and it was not an issue. Our governor went ahead and signed it. We had very strong bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate with the passage of the bill. So what did the bill do? It actually made about a dozen changes to our law. Some were just cleanup provisions. Some were codifying into the law conditions that had been added since the passage of the original initiative by our Medical Quality Assurance Commission. Our law provides that while there are provisions that are written into the law, conditions that are written into the law as being protected, that the Medical Quality Assurance Commission, now in conjunction with the Osteopathic Medicine and Surgery Board, can add conditions in response to anyone's petitions. But there were primarily three or four changes that were of crucial importance. One of the changes that was made was that the definition of a primary caregiver was changed and also renamed a designated provider. One of the bad court decisions that we had had over the years since the passage of the initiative looked at a definition in the initiative and said that in order for someone to be a primary caregiver to somebody for the purposes of helping them access medical marijuana, they actually had to be a caregiver in the sense of providing medicine, housing, clothing, meals, really taking care of them in the sense of a traditional caregiver that might be appointed by the state, for example. And so, all of a sudden, many of the people that were providing medical marijuana to medical marijuana patients were no longer protected by the law. So that was one of the changes that we were able to accomplish, was to make sure that if someone is designated a provider of medical marijuana by a patient, they're protected even if that's the only service that they provide to that patient. Another one of the changes that was important that came out of the bill was that we added a provision that provides now that a law enforcement officer, if he or she encounters a medical marijuana patient or a medical marijuana designated provider and makes the determination that this person appears to be in compliance with the Medical Marijuana Act, that the officer cannot seize the entire supply of medical marijuana of that patient. In fact, they can only take a sample that is large enough to test to see if it is, in fact, marijuana and leave the rest of the supply with the patient. The practice in our state, I don't know about anybody else with medical marijuana laws, but generally if an officer decided that somebody was possessing marijuana, either even if it was for a medical purpose and that was pretty clear, they could still seize everything as evidence and leave the patient without any medical supply at all because our law only provides an affirmative defense. In other words, a patient can be arrested, can be charged, may have to go all the way through a trial before they are able to avail themselves of the medical marijuana defense and be acquitted. We don't have arrest protection. We haven't taken medical marijuana patients and providers out of our criminal law altogether yet. And I know that that's the case in some other medical marijuana states, whereas others that have registries and ID card systems actually have greater protection. We don't have either an ID system or a registry, so we don't have that no arrest protection yet. The two biggest changes, one referenced by Paul and the one that's been the source of the most controversy, was the definition of a 60-day supply. And another change, I'm going to talk about these two together, is that in addition to coming up with what a presumptive 60-day supply is, the Department of Health now has to produce a report to our legislature that's also due by July 1 of 2008. And this report must address the provision of a safe, adequate, secure, and consistent supply of medical marijuana for patients. When we went into the legislature this past session, we had a variety of things that we wanted to fix with respect to the law. Two of the things that we asked for, we knew were big asks, and we knew that we were going to get pushback on them. One was, can we change our law from an affirmative defense to accepting, pulling patients and providers out of the criminal defense world altogether and making it so that if they're in compliance with specific conditions that the police officer can't even arrest them, they won't even get charged. That was one thing that we wanted to do. And the second thing that we wanted to do was to change our current status where a provider can only be designated for one patient, one patient to one provider ratio. So we don't have a specific protection in our law for collective gardening, for cooperatives, or for dispensaries. And we know that patient access is one of the biggest problems, if not the biggest problem, that our patients face in Washington State. So our two big asks that we weren't really sure how far we were going to get with them were, let's see if we can tackle access and let's see if we can tackle the arrest problem. When we went into the very first hearing in the legislative session, the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys and the Washington Association for Sheriffs and Police Chiefs came to the first hearing and said, look, we have a problem with this provision that you've asked for that says that we can't arrest anybody that might be a medical marijuana patient or prosecute them. And we have a problem also with trying to set up a provision that provides for collectives and cooperative growings. The reason why we have a problem with this is that the quantity of medical marijuana that's supposed to apply to each patient is only defined as a 60-day supply. We don't know what that is. What if that's 100 plants? What if it's, you know, 50 ounces? How do we know if a collective probably has too much medical marijuana for it to all be specifically for medical marijuana patients? How do we know it's not getting diverted? How do we know that some people aren't, in fact, violating, you know, taking advantage of the Medical Marijuana Act in order to pursue commercial interests? And if we can't have any specificity of what a 60-day supply is, it's going to be impossible for us to decide whether or not somebody is in compliance or not. It's going to be impossible for us to decide whether a collective is actually too big or not. And we need some clarity on that. This was where the conflict in Washington State started. Our position, the position of the ACLU of Washington, was that we wanted to continue to try to get this bill through with some improvements to the law, and we wanted to be able to do it in a way that wasn't going to set us backwards. We need to keep moving forward. We need to keep making improvements. So we decided that we would forego the no arrest provision, that we would stay with the affirmative defense. But here's what we did. We sat down and we dialogued with the prosecuting attorney's office, specifically the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys office, and said, look, we're not opposed to the idea of coming up with some guidelines for a 60-day supply, but how can we make this work better for patients? And what we came out with after the course of the legislative session, these hearings, you know, we had the first hearing in the House, but then, of course, it has to go, that's in a committee in the House, and then it has to go to the Rules Committee that has to decide to get it on the floor of the House. And then if it gets out of the floor of the House, you go over to the Senate, you start with the Senate Committee, you work your way up again, and then eventually, if both the House and Senate finally agree to one form of the bill, it makes it to the floor and gets voted on. There is a lot of room for a lot of changes to be made. And so we continued to work on the bill and to see if we could get something that we felt moved us forward and compromise to get the ball moving down the field. And so instead of creating a 60-day supply that is a hard maximum, what the prosecutors agreed with us is that why don't we create a presumptive amount? And first of all, let's not have politicians deciding what a 60-day supply is. Let's have somebody that's involved in health and science and medicine taking in information and deciding what that 60-day supply should be. We didn't want to be pushed into defining a 60-day supply during the 2007 legislative session. So that question has been allocated to the Department of Health, and the Department of Health is now engaging in a year-long process to come up with the presumptive 60-day supply. The second important key is that it is a presumptive amount, and nobody has lost the affirmative defense. Any patient that needs more than what the Department of Health comes up with still has the affirmative defense and can still go into court and present evidence of their actual necessary medical use. The 60-day supply is specifically designed to act as a safe harbor. In other words, if a patient or a provider only has a 60-day supply in his or her possession when encountered by police, that person will be presumed to be in compliance with the law. What we're hoping that this does is actually help us get toward a no-arrest experience. Even though the no-arrest provision is not written into the law now, by having a presumptive 60-day supply, what we're hoping we're going to see is that arrests will go down because the bright line that law enforcement is looking for to help their officer in the field decide who's in compliance and who's not will be there. And that hopefully will result, as a practical matter, in a bit of a no-arrest provision happening. So that's the conflict that came up during the legislative session and what we did and worked with it through the session to get a bill that we felt moved us forward. In terms of what lessons we could take away from this experience, you're not going to sleep, and you have to have thick skin. Those are a couple of things that I personally learned. But what else we learned is that running a bill through the legislature, and this is probably something that's not necessarily a new lesson, but it's a good reminder. Running a bill through the legislature is very, very different from running an initiative campaign. With the legislature, once you introduce that bill to the legislature, it is no longer yours. You are not in control of it. The words can change. You have no control over that. Any legislator can introduce any amendment that he or she wants to. And you have to make the decision for yourself how you're going to deal with that. And what I found to be true this year is that it is much more important when you're dealing with a legislature and a legislative bill to be a good communicator, to be able to sit down and communicate with people who oppose you, stakeholders that have different points of view than you, legislators that are scared, that don't know anything about this, that think that if they vote for something with the word marijuana in the title that they're going to lose their next election. You need to be able to talk with them as opposed to talking at them. In an initiative campaign, you get to frame your messages and run volleys back and forth at one another, and it's all about sort of marketing that initiative. That's not going to work with a legislature. With a legislature, you need to be able to sit down with people one-on-one and have good dialogue and good communication and find common ground. That's how you're going to have the most successful outcome with what you have in your bill, what you want to get out of your bill. And so dialogue, communication, one-on-one, meeting in meetings with legislators one-on-one, meeting with your opposition one-on-one, and frankly, meeting with those people early before the bill gets introduced is incredibly important because you need to know your chess plan. You need to know where your opposition's going to come in. You need to know where you're going to get pushback, and you need to figure out productive ways of negotiating that, figuring out what you're willing to give away, what you're not willing to give away. Are you going to sacrifice the bishop? Are you going to push the castle forward? You need to have these things in mind, and then you have to be flexible. You have to be flexible and fast on your feet because an amendment will be introduced hours before that bill is going to the floor, and you need to be able to figure out how you're going to respond to it, who you're going to talk to, and what's the most productive way to keep alive your hopes for what you're going to be able to bring out of the legislative session. You also have to be in it for the long haul. I think you've heard this from a number of speakers today, but legislation, the perfect medical marijuana bill, the perfect decriminalization bill, the perfect legalization bill is not going to happen. It is not going to happen in one session. It is going to be a long haul process, and you are, when you're engaging in the legislative process, as opposed to what some of us refer to as the drive-by initiative process, when you're engaged in the legislative process, you are establishing relationships with people that you're going to come back to year after year after year. The gay rights movement has figured this out. They haven't gotten everything that they wanted every year, but they keep coming back and they keep making movement in the right direction. I don't know that we're as successful at this yet. We have a tendency to think, if I don't get it all this year, I'm not going to have another chance. I'm not going to be able to come back and get something better next year or the year after that. Senate Bill 6032 is a perfect example of already building into the bill assurances that we will be back in the 2009 legislative session talking about additional improvements, because our Department of Health, by July 1, 2008, is going to be providing a report to the legislature about how we can go about providing better access to medical marijuana for patients. So we are going to be back in 2009 talking about that. And we may not get exactly what we want in 2009, but we can be back in 2010 in 2011, because we're in this for the long haul, and we're depending on developing those relationships over the years, depending on developing relationships with the people that we traditionally think of as our opposition, I've had plenty of Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorney members and Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs members come to me and say things like, you know, I have an aunt, I have a friend, I have a sister. Everybody has experienced that. Washington State legislators have experienced that. One of our Washington State legislators was a medical marijuana patient when he had cancer. When you operate from a place, and this is the last point really, the last takeaway point, when you operate from a place of fear and thinking that if you don't get everything you want now, you're not going to get anything else, and also thinking that people that you would traditionally classify as your opponents can't meet you in the middle somewhere and can't be moved in the right direction, you hurt yourself. You lose a lot of opportunities to keep the ball moving down the field. And I like to think of it, I know I'm just mauling the football analogy to death, and I'm just going to keep beating this dead horse, but we're not looking for touchdowns, we're looking for first downs. And the first downs will keep us moving down the field. And we'll keep developing the relationships with people that are stakeholders. We have to acknowledge that police officers, prosecutors, physicians, osteopaths, patients, there's a whole world of stakeholders. Parents, teachers, lots of stakeholders when it comes to marijuana generally and medical marijuana specifically. And we have to think of all of these people in a way that we're going to work with them to the extent that we can and move forward. We're not going to operate from a place of fear. Operating from a place of fear gets us nowhere. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
That was Allison Holcomb of the ACLU's Drug Policy Reform Project speaking at the 2007 Normal Conference in Los Angeles, California. You can link up for free to complete panels in audio from the 2007 conference to video and photos right up on a special 2007 conference page at the normal.org website. We have links to it on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. Madeline Martinez from Oregon Normal coming up next.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Next up today in our continuing showcase of 2007 Normal Conference audio here on the Audio Stash, we're going to hear really one of my personal heroes and a hero to many of those involved with Normal and many of those involved with Reform. Next up, it's Madeline Martinez, and here she is speaking at the 2007 Normal Conference. Madeline runs Oregon Normal, and she is an incredibly dynamic, caring, and articulate individual, and her success really is a model for what many of us can do and how we can all do more in our activism out there. Here's Madeline at the 2007 conference discussing state legislation in Oregon.
The next speaker will present another perspective from Oregon. Madeline Martinez heads Oregon Normal. They've been very active. They have their own collective that takes care of some of the patients under the current laws, and they have some concerns about the proposal. Madeline?
Thank you all very much. And let me just start out by saying thank you all, and I am not opposed to dispensaries. Oregon Normal knows that we need to get medicine out to the most needy patients. Our biggest concern is this the good time to do it? 2008 is faced with some horrible, a horrible initiative. It's IP-104, and it's brought to us by Kevin Mannix. And Kevin Mannix is a Republican activist and moral crusader. And he's bringing us IP-104. Section 1, I'd like to read this to you. This act shall be known as the Oregon Crime Fighting Act. The purpose of this act is to reduce all type of crimes in Oregon, thereby better protecting our people and stimulating the economic growth through improved and aggressive prevention. Early intervention, investigation, prosecution and accountability, and rehabilitation. Drug abuse and addiction are heavily associated with crime, and these problems are important targets for criminal justice. To fight crime, this act A, increases penalties for repeat major sex offenders and prevents registered sex offenders from holding public office. B, establishes meth forces to focus on drug crime and a coordinated grant program to improve funding for drug prevention and treatment programs. D, establishes a commission on domestic violence, child abuse, and sex crimes to propose reforms in these areas, as well as regarding use of the internet by sexual predators. E, prohibits convicted criminals from voting while incarcerated. F, provides for prompt prosecuting of suspected predators' DNA evidence in rape and sexual abuse cases. And G is very important. It replaces the Medical Marijuana Act with a more medically appropriate marijuana derivative and synthetic cannabinoid prescription program to focus help on those with legitimate needs. H, sets staffing standards to bring the Oregon State Police Patrol Division back to the levels achieved in the 1970s. I, establishes a retired senior volunteer police program to encourage retired police officers to continue to serve part-time. J, allows correctional officers to act as peace officers in the line of duty. K, increases penalties for repeat intoxicated drivers. L, requires criminal background checks on incarcerated persons before they are released. And M, restricts prison early release programs. Now, at Oregon Normal, we've taken the position to be neutral on the voter power initiative. We will not actively oppose it nor support it because we are concerned and we want to focus all of our attention on defeating Kevin Mannix. We feel it's a little absurd to try to amend a program that may no longer exist. I mean, really, realistically, this guy is a moral crusader, as I mentioned. He is funded by Lauren Parks, billionaire from Nevada, who is out there giving this guy $2 million at a time to go and do what he wants. And I think it's just, this is the focus of our attention. We are very concerned with protecting the existing law as we know it. Today, we don't want to go on all the synthetic THC. We would like to have our program remain intact. So we feel it's about time, and, it's very concerning to all of us at Oregon Normal. We want to get out there, and if any of you would like to donate to this cause, please make your contributions to the ACLU of Oregon and earmark it, Protect the OMA. And, I know that we're rushed for time. Am I still okay? Okay, great. So that's our position. We have not veered from that position. We know dispensaries are important. I'm going to be on another panel a little bit later to discuss what we do as a collective to distribute medicine. And things are pretty desperate for a lot of people out there in Oregon. They're looking for medicine everywhere, and we're trying to help them attain it. We just don't think this is the right time, and we just think it's a bad idea. Thank you all.
Madeline Martinez, the director of Oregon Normal there at the 2007 Normal Conference. We have complete audio panels for free, videos and photos right up on a special page at normal.org for the 2007 conference. Direct links to that page right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. You can pick up DVDs of that legislative panel, very reasonably priced and very cool content. Links to those are right up on that conference page as well. Again, links to everything right up at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting Technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.